content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic and the weekend edition of the News and Observer. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we begin with Miles Howard's article, The Revolutionary Idea Behind America's Urban Trails. Some of you may be familiar with Raleigh's Greenway, which has a goal to link trails around the capital city. As we will hear in Howard's story, greenways were first built in the late 1860s as a way to connect neighborhoods in busy urban centers. Today, climate change concerns among them are making the concept more popular with the development of nature walks, running and biking trails, and other new projects in U.S. cities. We begin. As a result of record visitation this summer, America's wide open spaces are feeling mighty cramped. To manage their teeming crowds, some of the most popular national parks are continuing to require advance reservations, with some packed state parks looking to do the same. But what if going for an epic hike or bike ride didn't involve driving hundreds of miles to the mountains? What if you could amble through a maze of flora and fauna right in the heart of a city? Savor the aroma of white violets, refuel with local gelato, and ride public transportation back home. Urban greenways could be the answer, and they're gaining in popularity in the United States. Fueled by climate change concerns, new car-free corridors dotted with woodlands, parks, and local sites are taking shape in cities including St. Louis and Detroit. But greenways aren't a new concept. Their roots go back to a time when American life was structurally segregated. In the first half of the 20th century and beyond, these oases offered more than recreation in the heart of a bustling city. They were a vision for connection and a more egalitarian version of American life. The power of public open spaces. Urban greenways were the brainchild of Frederick Law Olmsted, the legendary landscape architect who designed New York's Central Park in 1858. A decade later, Olmsted designed the nation's first greenway in Buffalo, New York, known today as the Buffalo-Olmsted Parks System. Soon after came the Emerald Necklace in Boston, Massachusetts. It was bigger, more ambitious greenway project integrating 16 neighborhoods and 7 miles of parks. The completed project takes people past the reedy marshes near Fenway Park, through the nation's oldest Victory Gardens, and across classical revival stone bridges to Harvard University's Arnold Arboretum, where more than 2,000 tree species reside. In the Emerald Necklace, Olmsted saw more than a refuge from daily life. Olmsted often spoke about the power of public open space to bring people of all walks of life together, and how they could be seen coming together, says Karen Moni Brodick, president of the Emerald Necklace Conservancy. On top of being this landscape architect, Olmsted had been a journalist. He founded the Nation with abolitionists after the Civil War. He was an expert on the scourge of the Southern slavery. He believed that through public parks, like the Emerald Necklace, the American people could become better participants in the Republic. Greenways were a radical idea in the wake of the Civil War and stood apart from a parks boom across the U.S., pioneered in Buffalo and Boston. Olmsted's greenway concept seemed primed to flourish in more cities. This idea partially manifested in some of his lesser-known projects, including in Atlanta's Druid Hills suburb, where his Olmsted Linear Park still links people to the city's urban core. But during the 20th century, Olmsted's vision collided with two antagonistic forces: the rapid rise of the automobile and the persistence of structural racism. Car versus community. The curvature of these nascent greenways and some of the parks within them made them ideal for road and highway development. Beginning in the 1920s, roads sliced through greenways to the detriment of pedestrians. The automobile played a huge role in changing parks, says Alan Banks, a landscape historian who served as a park ranger at the Frederick Law Olmsted National Historic Site for 30 years. In Boston, there's this very busy road called the Jamaica Way that runs along part of the Emerald Necklace, and at a public meeting about road work, someone got up and said, "Olmsted designed all these beautiful parks with views. What if we removed some trees so that drivers could see Jamaica Pond from the road?" To which someone replied, "You want to give people traveling 60 miles per hour a nice pond view to look at?" The trees by Jamaica Pond were not cut down, but in Boston's lower-income, multiracial neighborhoods, shade trees had become scarcer in the wake of the city's urban renewal surge in the 1950s and 1960s. Bustling boulevards cleaved predominantly black communities such as Dorchester and Roxbury, while predominantly white neighborhoods such as Brookline gained a disproportionately hefty share of the city's greenery. This trend wasn't limited to Boston. Across the U.S., urban development in the mid-20th century separated people of color from green spaces. Rising rent and real estate prices, active roads, and insufficient pedestrian infrastructure created barriers between underserved citizens and parks. A 2019 University of British Columbia study found that affluent white neighborhoods still enjoy easier access to parks and green spaces in U.S. cities. One of Boston's busiest multi-lane roads, Columbia Road in Dorchester, had almost become the concluding link of the Emerald Necklace. Olmsted had desired to build pathways connecting Franklin Park to the beaches at Dorchester Bay, but dense architecture and the trolley system that once ran along the road made the missing link of the necklace untenable. Ironically, finishing the necklace and seeding more green space in Dorchester ran the risk of causing adverse effects for residents, namely building modifications or demolitions and displacement. This would have echoed a dark chapter of Olmsted's earlier career when the city of New York used eminent domain in the mid-19th century to remove the residents of Seneca Village, a community of free black Americans and other blue-collar peoples. He then helped the city transform the emptied land into Central Park. His thoughts on the destruction of Seneca Village are a mystery and thereby a contradiction. For all of his idealism and innovations, Olmsted was still working within a system that routinely harmed marginalized communities in the name of civic development. As much as many people admire Olmsted's parks, it was still top-down planning, says Monty Brodick. These projects, even the most ambitious ones, require community engagement and real consensus building. In 1969, local activists in Boston showed how underserved communities could change consensus and take ownership of Olmsted's vision of connective green spaces. They stopped a highway project that would have cut through multiracial communities in South Boston, Roxbury, and Jamaica Plain. In its place, they persuaded the state to build a winding greenway of bike and pedestrian paths. It was dubbed the Southwest Corridor, and today it links more Boston neighborhoods to southernmost gems of the Emerald Necklace. A green revival. These days, American cities are rediscovering Olmsted's greenway vision. The trend is partly due to widening recognition of how urban planning has devastated communities of color, depriving them of green space and transit options. The other factor behind this greenway stimulus is worsening climate change and an emerging consensus that Americans must move away from cars as the default mode of transit. National and local sustainability plans like the Green New Deal are reimagining car-congested cities as places where people can thrive without cars. This means not only extending public transportation throughout cities, but also constructing more greenways to connect urban and suburban communities. In St. Louis, Missouri, city agency Great Rivers Greenway is building the Brookline Greenway, a network of urban trails that could be nearly 20 miles long when it's completed in 7 to 10 years. Three segments are set to open by 2025. Before COVID, our city parks saw about 2 trillion users a year, but last year alone we went to 3 million, says Suman Troutman, CEO of Great Rivers Greenway. The finished Brookline paths will accommodate the surging interest in greenways and increase access equity to green spaces, which Troutman adds is the project's backbone. "Our goal is to blur the spaces between neighbors," she says. In Atlanta, Georgia, planners are building on former railway corridors for the Beltline, wooded walking and biking paths that encircle the city, with tributaries to historic neighborhoods and parks. The project will stretch 22 miles once it's completed in 2022. Then there's San Francisco's Crosstown Trail, a sun-splashed 16.5-mile hike that cuts diagonally through the city from the beaches of Candlestick Point to the Land's End Cliffs at Golden State National Recreation Area, with stops at coffee shops and viewpoints along the way. New greenways alone will not guarantee equity of access to green spaces. Affordable rent-stabilized housing is an element missing piece in cities like San Francisco and Boston, where income inequality and housing shortages continue to cause displacement. But this tension further demonstrates the lasting relevance of Olmsted's Greenway vision. The idea of urban green spaces as a source for connection and the health of society was a progressive one when Olmsted ran with it in the 1860s, and it remains provocative today. But you don't have to imagine what his dream would look like. In many cities, you can walk it. And by the way, Miles Howard covers outdoor and urban recreation stories for National Geographic, the Boston Globe, Vice, which is a net publication, NBC News, and Southwest, the magazine. He is the author of Moon New England Hiking, and you can follow him on Twitter and Instagram. Again, the name is Miles Howard. Well, from urban trails, we're going to head west to Back on the Road down Highway 101, written by Ann Calcagno, and appearing in the Extra Living edition of the July 4th, 2021 issue of the News and Observer. Perhaps it's because my husband and I are baby boomers, nostalgically imprinted by mid-century road trips, but it took only an instant for us to settle on a bucket list trip. Newly vaccinated, we would drive down iconic Northern Highway 101 from Portland, Oregon to San Francisco, hugging the Pacific coast. We would hike redwood forests, loll by the Russian River, and take an inland detour to witness the soaring granite cliffs of Yosemite National Park. The clincher? Glamping in the retro glamour of refurbished Airstream trailers. The lore has it that Airstream founder, and that was Wally Byam, began engineering what would become his distinctly rounded aluminum-clad trailers in the late 1920s to overcome his wife's aversion to tent camping. By the mid-1930s, Airstream production became a thriving business, temporarily halted by World War II, that's still booming today. Byam died in 1962, but his Airstream creed lives on, to place the great wide world at your doorstep for you who yearn to travel with all the comforts of home. These days, Airstream stays are trending on Airbnb and Vrbo, or VRBO. Who could have predicted that nearly a century later, Byam's efficient vehicle would become a symbol of retro novelty? Planning to stay exclusively in rental Airstreams, we set out on our 8-day, 1,000-mile road trip. The first leg of our drive from Portland to coastal Pacific City, Oregon, turned glorious at Tillamook State Park. Steep slopes were thick with impossibly vertical Douglas firs, their feathery branches interwoven in bonanzas of dark green, draped in silvery lichen. At Pacific City, where Highway 101 bumps against Pacific Shoreline, our first Airstream awaited at Hart's Camp, a dog-friendly RV campsite and a designated enclave for 7 resident Airstreams, each with a privately fenced patio, a fire pit, Adirondack chairs, and an outdoor shower with a living plant wall. Our temporary home, rather, was a gleaming, riveted aluminum flying cloud. We punched in our entry code and instantly stepped into the offbeat luxury referenced in the camp's logo. Byam focused meticulously on Airstream's interior's efficiency. Tiny railings prevent items from falling. A press-fit cutting board covers the sink to extend counter space. Cabinets are pressure-hinged. Roller shades clip into place. Even the trash can is snug in a bespoke holder. Nostalgia is balanced with modern amenities, Bluetooth, surround sound, flat-screen TV, Wi-Fi, high thread count linens. I had definitely overpacked. My large hard-shell suitcase wouldn't fit in the closet. A row of vertical pasted surfboards, or pastel surfboards, excuse me, playfully marked the camp entrance. Wet-suited surfers left hugging their boards, crossing the street to the Pacific Ocean. A mile out, flat-bottomed dory boats took visitors around gigantic Chief Kawanda Rock. The Cape Kawanda State Natural Area sandstone headland is at the beach's northern end with a 2.2-mile hiking trail that's not to be missed. Whether for its stunning overlooks or glimpses of bright red-footed pigeon guillemot birds. On the beach, weather-sculpted driftwood provides seating. We felt the energy of people newly unmasked as nearly everyone greeted us with "What a beautiful day," despite the Pacific overcast. I grew up with Airstreams, a longtime Oregonian we met on our walk told us. My dad took us all sorts of places. Byam believed his campers were perfect venues for gathering with the like-minded spirits, playing some part in promoting international goodwill and understanding among peoples of the world through person-to-person contact. I experienced this in full as two enthusiastic trailerites back at camp anchored me in place, describing the joys and travails of Airstream ownership. We departed, pointed south for about 240 miles of Oregonian Highway 101. Yes, it runs through some pretty plain strip mall towns, but mostly we encountered dramatic panoramas, each one outdoing the last. Massive offshore rock outcroppings, enormous wave-washed beaches, cliffs rife with yolk-yellow Scotch broom, gnarled Sitka spruce trees rooted in warrior stances. Driving Highway 101 is less about your destination than about stopping spontaneously at pull-offs that require long gazes. Traveling Airstreams abound. 2 hours in, south of Yachts, we reached Cape Perpetua, part of the Siuslaw National Forest, Oregon's highest viewpoint by car, and a thickly forested headland that plunges 800 feet into the Pacific. On clear days, the coastal view reportedly extends 37 miles. We had no idea how much panorama we were taking in, but it stopped us in our tracks. Next, we made a short descent to totter over tide pools, marveling at neon green animals, until a hefty spray of salty water showered us from the spouting horn of Thor's well. Another 3 hours south, and we reach the Samuel H. Boardman State Scenic Corridor. Its 12-mile stretch offers dazzling aquamarine vistas from Cape Ferrello to House Rock to Whale's Head Beach and the offshore sea stacks of Arch Rock. This was our wonderful problem. We were tired, but it was impossible not to keep stopping. The Pacific didn't go anywhere during the pandemic, but it became untenable to many. No one we met took it for granted. A conversational refrain repeated. It started with the question I asked, or others asked of me, "Is this your first trip since COVID-19? The answer was invariably yes. I almost didn't believe it would happen. Or some variant of wonder, "Isn't it mind-boggling? This is all still exists, or I don't know how I live without it." We made it 33 miles south into California's Costa del Norte, Coast Redwood State Park. Its towering trees so immense we felt like we were shrinking. Another 100-plus miles took us into the Humboldt Redwood State Park's Avenue of the Giants driving loop, and the Redwoods experience became intense and trippy. We stopped and meandered among the recommended 2.4-mile Dreary Cheney Grove Cheriel, one of several hiking options, moving like sprites around standing and fallen redwoods, navigating through emerald carpets of grand sword ferns and flowering sorrel. My husband climbed into the opening of a living redwood as wide as four people. An hour south, in Trinidad, California, road exhaustion took its toll. We abandoned our mid-century lodging theme and checked into the Emerald Forest Cabins Resort. Refreshed, the 240 miles to Guerneville, California, excited us. We headed into Sonoma County wine country to stay in an Airstream at Auto Camp Russian River, where cars stay in a parking lot and guests transport their luggage in nostalgic radio red wagons. The sound of children running and laughing outdoors, so missed this past year, was our vivid greeting. Our site was shaded by the many trees lining the banks of the river and lushly landscaped. Our patio was outdoorsy, weathered wood glam. Inside, it was all 21st century amenities, minimalist decor in pastel tones, thick towels in guest bathrobes, a marble-tiled spa-style shower with marvelous high-end mattress. Auto Camp is a national chain whose trailers are tailor-made at the Jackson, Ohio Airstream factory. The 31-foot Airstream shells dutifully boast classic retro appeal, but each has a comfortable modern interior. Here the enticements included a 1,000-year-old redwood grove, complimentary Linus bikes, outdoor yoga, winery tours, and kayaking the Russian River. Truth is, I wanted to stay, maybe forever. But Yosemite beckoned, and we moved on. A half hour west, and we were back on Highway 1 inside Sonoma Coast State Park for a spectacular stop on the Pacific. In the Bodega Bay, where Hitchcock filmed The Birds, the scary church remains. We stopped for a hearty lunch at the waterfront Lucas Wharf Fishitarian Fish Market. Its sustainably sourced dishes were the best we had on this trip. Plump, lightly crusted calamari, tender Dungeness crab cakes, and deliciously seasoned clam chowder. Add two amusing elephant seals, noisily competing to sunbathe on the pier, and we departed well-fed and entertained, ready for the four-hour drive to Auto Camp Yosemite. The next hour of narrow wilderness on Highway 1 was an enchantment, deliriously close to turquoise waters swathed in intermittent mist. Subsequently overtaken by bright sun shining on cattle and horse ranches, our eyes and noses processed the interweaving smells of animal hides and salt spray. Veering inland, the scenery was long stretches of almond and pistachio farms until we glimpsed foggy San Francisco Bay with cargo ships trawling wares. Then it was down to real business, 3.5 hours going east on Interstate 580. Four-lane commuter traffic, lush scenery behind us to reach Auto Camp in Mid-Pines, 26 miles outside of Yosemite. We were tense and discouraged, knowing we had tried to cram too much into an 8-day span. We staggered into Auto Camp's mid-century modern lodge, barely able to appreciate its cool respite. But we knew the drill. Leave the car, choose a luggage wagon. On the way in, we passed a swimming pool that immediately became a priority. If Russian River was a sweet enclave, Yosemite was a hilly village. Our Airstream faced the camp's central pond. Settling in around our fire pit, munching food we bought at the lodge, we listened to the evening's awakening crickets and eager to mate bullfrogs. Once again, an astonishing number of outdoor activities were on offer. Horse rides, hikes, skydiving, whitewater rafting, and more. But we had arrived with monocle vision, determined to drive into Yosemite. Our required $35 car permit settled in the glove box. In hindsight, I realized we could have taken the daily Yarts bus, which stops right outside the camp, for $20 round trip. State Route 140 to the park is a gnarly but scenic 26-mile drive, sort of like mogul skiing. Evidence of past fires appeared in swaths of forest remaindered into black skeletons. Road repairs and rock slide prevention work made for periodic long stops. We had never been so done with driving. Roads were shut to Cathedral Rocks and Bridal Veil Fall and the Mariposa Grove, and yet Yosemite Valley transformed us to sagging hearts. We parked along Northside Drive and ambled transported on a looping trail through the meadowlands and oak groves and Stellar's Jays zipping by. On the banks of Yosemite Creek, brown-headed canvasback ducks plunged and preened. But, of course, it's not so much about looking down as about gazing up at the massive granite cliff faces of Half Dome and El Capitan. The latter, rising 3,593 feet, is perhaps the tallest exposed vertical face of granite on Earth. In proximity, we realized how starved we had been for natural wonders. Outside Yosemite Village, we took a very crowded trail to lower Yosemite Falls. People clambered over boulders at its base to catch the spray. Perhaps risk-taking is one COVID legacy, the response to disbelief at being sprung free. It was a shock to suddenly find ourselves in crowds. Plus, it was time to head back, anticipating being stalled by road work, which we were. In the parking lot, a young couple stepped out of a van. They opened the side and back doors, revealing self-outfitted camper. We soon were talking about the downsizing movement, the long lockdown, and our shared resolve to never again put places we want to go on the back burner. Back at camp, children dashed gleefully along the airstreams, their laughter echoing. A mother looked on. "They're finally sprung free," she said. "Why did you choose an airstream to stay?" I asked. "I've never been much for camping," she said, "but when my husband found this and I saw the pictures, I was like, I can do that," just as Wally Byam had envisioned. Wow, what a story that is, huh? Well, how about some places for some short romantic getaways? Now, this is Great Places, written by Megan Wood of Oyster.com. It appeared in the Extra Living edition of the July 4, 2021 issue of the News and Observer, and we'll give you a couple of excerpts with the remaining time we have. Big on love, but short on time, no worries. We've got U.S. destinations that are perfect for packing in a few days of romance. Whether you and your love want to take a beach vacation in Miami, soak away your cares in Palm Springs, Hot Springs, or cozy up to the vineyards near the Hamptons, we found the perfect short romantic getaway to make sparks fly. Read on and fall in love. And here are some of them. Las Vegas. Move over, Virginia. Las Vegas is for lovers. Whether you want to put it all on red on your anniversary date, hit up a topless pool, or take in a world-class show, Las Vegas caters to romance and couples looking for a 24/7 good time. The beauty of a short trip to Las Vegas is that you can pack a week's worth of activities in a long weekend thanks to late-night gambling, nightclub and restaurant hours, and almost nonstop entertainment. Next, we have the Hamptons. For many East Coasters, heading to the Hamptons isn't just about the beach. It's also about boutique shopping, European-inspired restaurants, and vineyards. For couples whose ideal getaway includes biking along the beach, stopping for a picnic of wine and cheese, spending the afternoon in multiple vineyards, and popping champagne at a nightclub, the Hamptons is the short romantic getaway, the best short romantic getaway possible. As the weather gets hot, it's the Hamptons, not Manhattan, that becomes the place to see and be seen. Then we have Miami. Miami is booming. This internationally beloved coastal city has seemingly everything to offer. Gorgeous beaches, inventive dining, Latin flavor, designer shopping, art deco architecture, and pleasant weather year-round. Couples who want to pack a lot of romance into a short trip really can't go wrong in Miami. Looking for a flight deal? Well, check flights into Miami International Airport and nearby Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport, just 17 miles apart. And you can swim and sunbathe topless on South Beach. And then we have Palm Springs, California. Palm Springs, the short romantic getaway of choice for Los Angeles residents, especially LGBTQ couples. Nature-loving and wellness-oriented couples can hike Joshua Tree National Park, take a sound bath in Integration, and post up in some soothing hot springs. The other places mentioned are Portland, Maine, Napa Valley, California, New Orleans, and, of course, the Big Apple, New York City. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's episode of Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments may be directed to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.